when are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Hello, welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
I'm Arliss Bunny.
And today on the show, we'll be talking about Catalonian independence and the constitutional crisis in Spain. And as promised, Arliss is back on her beat of financial news and monetary policy with coverage on the Vatican Bank.
For the interview, we have Joe Firestone, author, economist, political scientist, and one of my favorite people, who has a new book available on Amazon, Who Needs Balanced Trade? Who Needs Balanced Budgets?
But before we get to all of that, I talked about bacon, essentially, last week. What do you have on your slate this week?
I have salacious representatives. I'm telling you, this was an interesting week to be from my little southeastern corner of Indiana. Luke Messer is our congressman here, and he's the fifth ranking member of the House leadership. He's the chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee. He's a young guy. He swept in 2010. I've met Luke. He's not a bad guy. He's not a mean guy. He's not Trey Gowdy, but he's certainly from the far, far right of the Tea Party. With all this hubbub, with the stepping down of John Boehner, Messer certainly wants to step up. He's been eyeing the position of Republican Conference Chair, which is currently held by Kathy McMorris Rogers, the only woman in all of GOP congressional leadership. So, of course, Messer wants her job. Needless to say, there's a certain amount of kerfluffle. Meanwhile, my representative to the Indiana House is Judd McMillan. And you may have heard about this in the national news, because even though it's been a busy news week, there's always room for this kind of crazy. McMillan is the was the majority floor leader. He swept in also in 2010. He beat Bob Bischoff. And by the way, Bob was a great representative, a Democrat. He'd been representing this district for 30 years. Everybody liked Bob, but nobody bothered to come out and vote. Democrats, you must vote in order to be represented. Anyway, Bob was swept out by Judd McMillan, and McMillan has risen steadily, was seen to be somebody that might have gubernatorial aspirations. But this last week, he sent a text out to everybody on his contact list apologizing for any kind of text they may have received from him in the last few days, because, as he says it, his phone was stolen from him and it was out of his control for 24 hours. And someone sent a video of him having sex with someone other than his wife to everyone on his contacts list.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And here's the best thing about Jen. First of all, he's, of course, resigned to focus on his family. But when our governor, Governor Pence, was trying to back down because of the business repercussions of RFRA, McMillan...
RFRA being the anti-gay marriage nonsense that caused people to talk about boycotting Indiana.
Exactly. And Pence finally got the message. And when he tried to completely back down on it statewide, Judd McMillan wouldn't let him. And so, yeah, individual families across the state now, or individual cities, can vote to challenge RFRA. In other words, to not have RFRA in their city limits. But in my area, which is a rural district, RFRA still applies here. Thanks to Judd McMillan, Mr. Family.
So Mr. Family is running around taking videos of himself on his phone, having sex with people who aren't his wife, but marriage is some sacred institution that is under attack and needs to be protected. You know what? I will say marriage is under attack by people like this guy who don't want other people to be married, and yet who talk about family values and then are complete hypocrites who are sleeping with people who aren't their wives, which normally I wouldn't care about. But in this circumstance, it's newsworthy because this guy is a big family values guy who's just, ugh.
Yeah, and my thing is, I don't care who sleeps with who. As long as it's not, frankly, my husband sleeping around, it's none of my business. But when he takes a stand against other people being married, and when he puts forth his faith and his quote-unquote belief in marriage, then he's signing up as a hypocrite. So my final word on this is, judge not lest ye be judged, judge.
Today we're talking about the Catalonian independence movement. Catalonia is recognized by Spain as an autonomous region with protected culture. It's in the northwestern corner of Spain and contains that ancient city of Barcelona. In the lead up to the parliamentary election on 27 September, a coalition of pro-independence parties came together under the banner of Juntos por Sí, United for Yes, promising that if they won the election, Catalonia would become an independent country. They made this promise after holding non-binding referendums in which the Catalonian people voted overwhelmingly for independence. By overwhelmingly, I mean 80% of the people voted for Catalonia to become an independent state. An additional 10% voted that Catalonia should be an independent state that is still technically part of Spain, such as the Irish Free State being a member of the British Empire, and only around 4.5% of people voted for the status quo. That referendum was declared to be illegal by the Spanish Constitutional Court, and depending on which newspaper you read, the government may already be in the process of trying to arrest the elected officials who held it. The Spanish government is refusing to allow the Catalonians to hold a legal referendum, and so as a result, the only option open to the Catalan people was to declare their legal election for Parliament a proxy referendum on independence, which the pro-independence parties won outright. Historically, the constitutional settlement of Spain was never really settled, especially when it comes to those parts of Spain which have consistently argued for their independence: Catalonia, the Basques, Galicia. The politicization of history, fact, and law has made discussing and studying this topic damnably difficult, even if the etymology of Catalonia's name has been politicized. Historically, the name Catalonia first appears for us in the 11th century, referring to the Catalanensis in their homeland. There are a number of theories as to where this name came from. One of the more accepted theories is that Catalonia is a linguistic descendant of Gotolandia, referring to the Goths or Gotland. But French and Catalonian scholars suggest that the name derives from a Roman misinterpretation of the name of the Lacatani tribe. As Gotland evolved into Gotlandia and Gotolandia, Lacatan was misspelled by the Romans as Catalan, and the name for these people was given as Catalanensis, a name later used by the Duke of Barcelona and the kings of Aragon. There's also the idea that Catalonia means land of castles, making it linguistically identical to the name Castile. This is used by a lot of Spanish scholars as it implies that Catalonia is not now and never has been a nation, and that the Catalonians are all just Spaniards who insist on speaking a backwards dialect of Spanish. It's a tactic of erasure from a government that wants to forge a single nation and keep together what is essentially an Iberian Yugoslavia. The reason that I tend to agree with French and Catalonian scholars that the Catalonian name comes from the Lacatanii is because of the other evidence that supports a direct connection between modern Catalonians and the pre-Roman Iberians. Specifically, that connection would be that the Catalonians are the pre-Roman Iberians. That connection is their language. The Catalan language is spoken today in an almost exactly the same region in which the Iberian cultures existed. The same thing is true of the Basque language with the Celtiberians. Borders, rulers, and governments have changed countless times for the past 2,500 years. The Roman and Carthaginian invasions, Greek-Roman and Phoenician colonization, the rise of Charlemagne, the Arab-North African invasions, the Reconquista, the wars of the Spanish Succession, the wars with Napoleon. The borders, rulers, and governments all change countless times. But that map of the Catalonian language, of Catalan, never shifts. Catalan still exists and is still spoken within the borders of those ancient Iberians. A territory occupied by this language and by Catalan culture never once changes in any point in our recorded history. The Catalonians as a people, I would argue, predate the idea of Spain and even its ancient name, Hispania. Barcelona itself is at least 7,000 years old and has been continuously inhabited for all of written history. Clearly, Catalonia is a nation and always has been. That may all be well and good, say the Project Fair variety of unionists, but think of the economy. And by that, they mean only the Spanish economy, to which Catalonia contributes a great deal while getting not all that much out of it in return. Because of its autonomy, Catalonia is one of the regions in Spain that hasn't, through corruption and idiotic austerity, completely mismanaged itself into economic oblivion. They have a strong agricultural sector, which includes winemaking. They have a massive pharmaceutical sector. They have the largest port by trade volume in all of Europe. They have one of the busiest airports in Europe. And that's all because of the tourist industry. They have Barcelona. It's one of the number one tourist attractions in the world. Their port is also the largest cruise ship port in Europe as a result of Barcelona. Last decade, Disney World Orlando was the number two tourist destination on the planet after the country of Spain. A massive chunk of that tourist income is due to Barcelona and Catalonia. The Catalans don't want their prosperity torn away from them by the IMF and the Eurozone in order to pay for the corruption of Madrid. On their own, they'd be more than fine. It's in their economic interests to cut ties with the pathetically dysfunctional government in Madrid, which insists on telling them that they're not a country. The relationship between the Catalans and who we might call the Castilians is soured to the point that the two nations are now on a collision course with the Basques and Galicians looking on from the sidelines. The Castilians wouldn't let the Catalonians vote, and the result is this. The ruling party, the PPC, which would be the People's Party, I know that sounds communist, but it's actually a right-wing pro-austerity party, they came next to last in the recent election, which is a big smackdown for the ruling government. The only people who did worse for them would be the tiny socialist party that is pro-independence and wants Catalonia to be an independent socialist state outside of the European Union. So those folks are the only people that did worse than the PPC. The PPC is one of only two parties in Catalonia that opposes a referendum on independence or opposes independence outright. The other party that opposes the independence movement and that opposes the right of Catalonia to hold a referendum is the Citizens Party, the CiS. And they are the only other party clearly opposed to the referendum and to Catalonian independence. They represent only about, together, those anti-independence parties represent only 25% of the seats and only about 25% of the vote. The other 75% of parties in Catalonia, 75% of the parliament, either completely supports Catalonian independence, supports the right for Catalonia to have an independence referendum, but is internally divided on independence, or supports independence outright, but wants to be a country outside of the European Union. That would be the CUP. The other big party in Spain, sort of the PSOE version of, in Catalonia, which would be the major left-wing party in Catalonia or in Spain, they are internally divided on the question of independence and officially abstain. That would be the PSC, the Socialist Party of Catalonia. They do not take any official position, and they have members who would vote yes in an independence referendum, and they support the right of the Spanish people to hold one. The sort of Syriza group, the Green Party that has come together, they defend the right to self-determination and themselves are openly divided on the question of how they would vote in an independence process. So when the news reports that 48% of the political parties want Catalonian independence, that's not entirely true. 48% of the political parties, or the people who are in the Catalonian parliament, support independence outright. Then 75% of them support the right of Catalonia to make its own decisions, and a good portion of those folks in that 75% support independence as well.
Well, the crushing of the Greek anti-austerity movement by the Troika clearly affected Italy and Spain in particular. Can you talk a little bit about that in reference to Catalonia?
Well, as I mentioned before, Catalonia is a region that is particularly prosperous and that has really been frustrated with the economic policies of Spain for a long time now. As far as the economics are concerned, it's not been a major part of the debate, at least in the sources that trickle down to me. There's the Project Fear folks who are trying to make people scared about Catalonia's economic future. But generally, they're shying away from the topics of what they might do economically because everyone agrees that Catalonia would be fine, which is rather interesting because Catalonia would be fine, but Spain's not. Spain itself has all sorts of industries that could be doing fantastically if it wasn't for the austerity that's been imposed upon them by the IMF, by the Eurozone, by the Troika. It's part of what is destabilizing Spain right now is that sort of crushing of the Greek anti-austerity movement.
Right.
And the idea that it is, for a lot of people, is if Catalonia breaks away, then they're freed of the debt of Greece. They're able to make their own decisions about their own economy. And there are folks in Spain who listen to the MMT perspective and would want Catalonia to work with the European Union and try to join it, but keep their own currency as opposed to being part of the euro. That has been part of the discussion in certain economic forums. And I would hope that that becomes the major part of the conversation, but there are also a lot of folks that support the euro. So there are a lot of questions as to Catalonia's economic future and what kind of process they'd want and what kind of currency they want. It's not a question whether or not they'd be prosperous. Clearly they would. They have a massive economy. They're in a better situation than the rest of Spain, which is, again, one of the reasons that they want to break away. They don't want to be held responsible for the mistakes made by the Spanish government.
Randall Ray's book, which is probably the most important text available on modern monetary theory, was just translated into Spanish this year specifically for release in Spain. I think MMT is aware of the effect it's having there. Several professors have gone to lecture in Spain recently on the subject, so I think there's an increase in education around MMT in Spain happening right now.
And I would say that Syriza is probably a party that looks in an MMT direction. Not Syriza, Podemos. I think I've incorrectly talked about Syriza when I meant Podemos. Podemos would be the Spanish anti-austerity movement. I think they are much more in an MMT direction because they have a much stronger academic backing than Syriza had. When they have a completely different organizational style. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Podemos.
So next up, I'll be talking about the Vatican Bank. Thanks for listening to Hopping Mad. We'll be right back. Thank you.
This is Arliss Bunny, and today I'm talking about the Vatican Bank. Inside the Holy See, the Vatican Bank is known as the IOR, the Institute of Religious Works, or some people call it God's Bank, though, frankly, in my opinion, there's an old saying about a camel in the eye of a needle, but I'm not going to go there today. The Vatican Bank was incorporated in 1942 during World War II, and its function at the time was to protect and direct the assets of the Vatican from both the Nazis and from the Allies. In fact, in history, up until 1887, the treasury of the Holy See was in gold coins in a trunk kept under the Pope's bed. And then they had kind of an interim structure, and then what is now considered the modern Vatican Bank. The intention of the Vatican Bank itself, as of 1942, was to be able to provide quiet funding for Vatican activities in unfriendly places. For instance, during the 1980s, Pope John Paul II wanted to be able to provide funding to Solidarity, and he did that through the Vatican Bank. And because the Vatican Bank is so opaque, he was able to do that without anyone knowing. The other function of the Vatican Bank is to provide actual banking services for members of the clergy, members of the laity who work in the Holy See, for parishes that don't have their own financial structure. In other words, they're just not big enough to support a financial structure, for Catholic hospitals, for retirement savings for clergy, and for certain kinds of projects that the Catholic Church has around the world. Religious orders hold about 85% of all of the Vatican Bank's assets. Vatican Bank, differently than most other banks, holds about 25% of its assets in cash. And this is because, frankly, of collection plates around the world. And all of that money doesn't get transferred from, say, Ohio to the Vatican Bank in the form of cash. What happens is the Vatican Bank has relationships with what are called correspondent banks all around the world. So if you're a parish in Ohio, you have an account with a correspondent bank and you're making a cash deposit there. But that is considered a cash deposit against the Vatican Bank. So you can see how with this volume of cash, there's an opening for corruption that indeed plays into the Vatican's history. Additionally, because Vatican Bank was set up to be an opaque organization, it's made it easy for Vatican to people say, and I want to be clear that a lot of this is not known for sure, for the Vatican Bank to be involved in things like funding for the Contras, funding for any communist guerrillas in Argentina, El Salvador, Honduras, funding going into Iran, Iraq, Syria, Indonesia. All of that was kind of, or is thought to have been kind of commonplace for Vatican Bank for a long time. And then 9/11 happened. And at that point in time, banking around the world changed because regulation of banking around the world changed. And that was the beginning of the end for the way the Vatican used to function. There is quite a history of scandal associated with the Vatican Bank. They have a long and old ties with the mafia and, frankly, with tax evasion. And this is because Vatican is smack in the middle of Rome. And so for a lot of wealthy people, it's basically across the street. So they have an account at Vatican Bank, or they had an account at Vatican Bank. And because it was in another country, they didn't have to declare that on their Italian taxes, or they chose not to declare it on their Italian taxes. And the Vatican Bank was so opaque, and it didn't exchange tax data with Italy. So those people basically were able to park their money there transparently. That, again, makes Vatican Bank ripe for corruption, all of that combined. It is thought, in fact, that even as far back as World War II, up to $225 million in Nazi gold, unclaimed, ended up at Vatican Bank. Now, during the 70s and the early 80s, a man named Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, and he was an American, by the way, was in charge of the Vatican Bank, and he set up a series of 10 shell companies and borrowed against Vatican assets for up to $600 million to loan to the Italian Banco Abruzziano, which was said, even at the time, to have had very close ties to Sicilian mafia. The bank ultimately collapsed in 1982, and there was a $1.3 billion hole. In other words, just missing money. Now, Obviously, the Vatican didn't end up taking any direct responsibility, but they ultimately made $224 million in quote-unquote goodwill payments to creditors. And at the same time, they allowed Marcinkus to hide in the Vatican. So they did not give him to Italian authorities, no matter what Italian authorities wanted. And it did cost the Vatican hundreds of millions of dollars, not only in settlement, but in lawyers' fees to defend themselves from this mess. And their response to all of that was, we answer to God. In other words, they consider themselves above regulation. Then you get to the 1990s and a man named Monsignor Nunzio Saccarano. And Saccarano was also called My Lord 500 because of his penchant for carrying 500 euro notes around with him. And he ultimately reported a burglary. And when he did that, the Guardia di Finanza came in and took a look around and realized that he had millions of dollars of art hanging on his walls. And finally, they looked into his finances and discovered that he had 2.3 million euro in his personal accounts. This is a guy whose salary is 36,000 euro a year. So they started to ask some questions. And what they found was that, or what they are contending, is that he was taking kickback on money laundering for the mafia. So all of that, of course, made the papers in a huge way and made the situation for Vatican even worse. Meanwhile, there were other kinds of transactions. Vatican had $23 million in money it had deposited at a correspondent Italian bank, confiscated by Italian authorities because the Vatican had refused to supply appropriate documentation for that $23 million. And again, what they initially gave as their response on that was, we answer to God. And they resisted until finally the Italian authorities confiscated the $23 million and backed the Vatican into a corner. They had to provide the paperwork. They did. They got their money back. But it was the process that was so frustrating. Ultimately, correspondent banks were forced by the Troika and, in fact, even by American regulators to stop doing business with Vatican Bank because Vatican Bank had become so dicey. And organizations like Deutsche Bank, who were running the Vatican's 80 ATMs, shut them down. And by the way, Vatican Bank was so opaque that its ATMs were all in Latin. But those all got shut down at a peak business time. The Vatican lost a ton of money on them. Now, Pope Benedict made some kind of tentative stab at, you know, drawing in the Vatican Bank and trying to clean it up a little bit, but he didn't really empower his new regulators in the way that they needed to actually clean it up. Pope Francis did a whole different thing. And in fact, one of the reasons that he was thought to have been chosen by the Curia was that they were very, very concerned about Vatican Bank at the time of the conclave. So because Francis had a history of cleaning up financial messes in Buenos Aires, it was thought that he could do a good job cleaning up things at the Vatican Bank. So Francis moved immediately to eliminate things like obvious excesses, but he also brought in high-level, very experienced Catholic cardinals and laity into new positions and replaced people in existing positions so that he could have not only people that he could personally rely upon, but people who had the skill set to go in and deeply address the problems of corruption within Vatican Bank. Of the 16,900 accounts at Vatican Bank, 3,300 were shut down and 200 of those were referred for action because they were considered to be suspicious. Vatican departments must now all produce quarterly reports that compare spending to budget. The Vatican itself is audited by outside, independent, well-respected auditors every year, and an annual report is produced. Francis empowered watchdog committees that, and in multiples, so that they overlap, to watch out for what's going on at Vatican Bank, and he separated property management from the actual functions of the banking itself. And he created something called the Secretariat of the Economy and put a very, very experienced financial regulator, Cardinal Pell, in charge of the Secretariat of the Economy. And this is someone who sits on the Pope's C9 Council, his Council of Nine Cardinals. So the Pope hears from him on a regular basis. Francis stays right on top of this. Oh, And the other thing that Francis did was that he's requiring priests and laity in key positions in parishes that handle a great deal of money to take business courses and financial management courses in conjunction with Villanova. So he really is focused on this. And what the Financial Times has said is that Francis' papacy will be a mission to prove that the church remains a touchstone for morality. And to some observers, he has defined the bank scandal as an opportunity. And that's from Rachel Sanderson at Financial Times. I think that's really wise, and I think it's a very accurate description of Francis's thinking on the process. Thank you. This has been Arliss Bunny. Next up is Joe Firestone talking to us about his new book. We're returning on Hopping Mad. We're interviewing Joe Firestone, PhD, today. Joe is one of the, I want to say, leading lights of modern monetary theories, something that's, of course, near and dear to this bunny's heart. So, Joe, you've just released, this last Tuesday, just released a book called Who Needs Balanced Trade? Who Needs Balanced Budgets? What brought you to write that? That's a pretty specific topic, and given everything you've already written on the TPP, the TPP, what brought you to write this book as an extension of that?
Well, the first thing that that I thought of, actually, was that when critiquing the TPP specifically or the other trade deals, but specifically, it's generally true that the critics are very good at pointing out what's wrong with those deals, but they seem to me to be a little short on providing a vision which is an alternative to free trade. So it seemed to me one of the reasons why the meme of having free trade is so powerful, okay, is because it's either a free trade economy or it's a protectionist economy. And so, you know, debate goes back and forth and everybody comes down, well, you know, free trade is certainly better than a protectionist economy. So it seemed to me that that free trade still captures the imagination of people because there isn't a viable alternative. What I wanted to do in this book was to provide such an alternative. I wanted to show that, first of all, what's important is to integrate trade policy with other government policy, and particularly fiscal policy, and to evaluate them all in the same way, in terms of whether they contribute to public purpose or whether they don't contribute to public purpose. Because it seemed to me that's what we're about, actually, public purpose, okay, or the government ought to be.
Well, one would hope.
About, because why have the government if it's not going to act for public purpose? In other words, that's the reason for being of the government.
You mean the purpose isn't to bolster corporations and political power?
Well, of course, it all depends on who you talk to. Okay, but if you talk to you or me or to people, you know, what they're going to say is, you know, we elect the government to do things for everybody.
It just doesn't.
It just doesn't, of course.
Yeah. So one of the mantras of modern monetary theory is imports are real benefits, exports are real costs. That's in contravention to the belief that exports are the real benefit. So what's real?
Well, what's real is When you send a good to somebody, a car or something like that, okay, a television, okay, or something like that, you're sending them something concrete. When you send them a machine tool or you send them a new capital product, okay, of some kind, then that's something they can use to further produce things and to increase the real wealth. And those things, there are many of those real things, endure over a period of time and continue producing value. With money, that's something which ultimately originates with the government, and in our system today, it's by fiat. So it's a creation, okay, of our will, and it's a very abstract sort of creation. It's useful to distinguish what we can do through the decisions of banks, okay, and governments from the things we actually produce with our minds, okay, and our hands, and our machines.
Right.
And to create essentially two categories there. Okay, now in economics, it's become the custom to refer to the latter kinds of things, okay, as real things, okay, and to refer to money as nominal things. So a distinction is made between the nominal wealth and the real wealth of a society. To some degree, those terms are not very fortunate, okay, because everything is real, including money. Okay, but the purposes of money are different, and the uses of money, okay, are different. So the distinction is a valid one conceptually. It's just that the terminology can sometimes be confusing.
In talking about free trade, there's an absolute dissonance between the model and reality. Neoliberals really cling to the what's called the Ricardian model. What is that? And why is it that it fails so completely?
Okay, well, it's a model which was developed for a very special case by Ricardo in the early part of the 19th century. It dates from about, I think, 1818 or something like that, 1815. And what he did is he wanted to justify trade with foreign countries and the creative effects of relying on specialization. And so he created a sort of toy example involving two nations and two products. And what he showed in using that example is that in that sort of case, it will be better for both nations to trade with each other in spite of the fact that one of those nations might have a clear productivity advantage in both of the two products. Well, I shouldn't say a productivity advantage, okay, but an absolute advantage in terms of the production of the two products. What he meant by an absolute advantage, okay, was that one of the countries might be able to do a better job, okay, of actually producing both of the products. He said, even in situations like this, it is possible for trade to be good for both sides. How does that work? He said, well, there could be not just an absolute advantage, but a comparative advantage. And what he meant by a comparative advantage was that one of the two parties, while maybe it's not as good as actually producing goods as the other party, still would have less of a disadvantage in producing that particular good but then the other party had an advantage, so that it would somehow pay. In other words, from this he deduced, okay, that it would pay for one of the parties to specialize in what it had the most advantage in, and the other party to specialize in what it had the least amount of disadvantage in. And by spinning out the conclusions, he was able to show that if both parties traded on that basis, and they were careful to keep improving their industries over time, that the eventual result of the situation would be that there would be more products produced at a lower cost, and that trade would therefore be beneficial to both nations taken as a whole. Now, the reason why it doesn't work is as follows. First of all, we don't have two nations and two products.
Right.
We have hundreds of nations and thousands of products.
Millions, I'm sure.
Well, we may not have millions actually traded right now, but we could have millions. In other words, potentially, you know, the number of products we can think up, is not something we can easily count at this time. Okay, so so this situation of trade is not a two-nation and two-product situation. It's a far more complex situation of interrelationships and transactions that are impossible to predict in a from a mathematical model, and that are impossible even to derive from a simulation model that doesn't look like it has a bunch of arbitrary assumptions.
So the... I mean, other things that Ricardo left off were, and in fact, neoliberals leave off in their modeling, are things like transportation cost, quality, real wages. They assume the frictionless mobility of labor, weather, commodity access and commodity manipulation, the effect of currency trading. All of those things somehow get left out of the conversation.
All of those things are neglected in the conversation,
yeah.
But also all of the internals of the two nations.
Right.
Okay. In other words,
politics.
When two nations trade, they're viewed as essentially homogeneous entities, super actors in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really going on in trade, okay, is that a bunch of individual companies inside of the nations are trading with one another. It's not just two nations, it's all these companies. And there are people that are working for these companies, and there are people that are consuming products from these companies, okay? And there are people benefiting, and there are people losing. There are winners, okay? There are losers. And we can tell very easily who the losers are going to be beforehand and who the winners are going to be beforehand. And we can't tell what the intensity of losses is going to be. In other words, we can't tell how many families are going to be destroyed by these trading relationships.
Right.
How many lives are going to be destroyed. How the economy is going to reconstruct itself.
Even people like Warren Buffett seem to be afraid of a trade deficit. Is a trade deficit a source of economic vulnerability or instability?
It all depends on what the government does to compensate for a trade deficit. Okay, what the United States, what's happening to the United States when it runs a trade deficit is that that represents a leakage of demand from a domestic economy into foreign economies. In other words, there's money going out of the United States, and that money is not available for consumption here. So that's what's happening. That's what also happens when people in this country are saving money, okay, as opposed to spending it. So if the total of what you send in money outside plus the total of what you save is, say, 10% of GDP per year, then you've lost 10% of the demand in the economy.
Which is the problem with plunging so much money into the 1%. And in fact, that kind of brings me back to a question I was going to skip because of time. But is it my imagination, or are things like the Ricardian model, the Reinhardt-Rogoff fiscal cliff, the long-proven failed trickle-down economics, all shibboleths of the 1%, are those used to hide or to distract our attention from their true purpose?
They are, of course, but these are like complex social things that have actually developed over time and serve particular functions. It's not that anybody necessarily planned this to happen, though, of course, at this late date of all the interactions involved, I'm sure there are people who consciously are using this in order to justify the domination of the 1%, okay, or the 1,000th, the 1%. But these are things which actually developed over time as societal justifications for the development of inequality. Now, I don't think that free trade necessarily started out in that way. In other words, at the end of the Second World War, people wanted to engage in free trade because they honestly thought that it was going to be better for most of, the economies of the world. But of course, because of the fact that the Ricardian theory doesn't apply, it created all kinds of dislocations all over the world.
Right.
And especially in the developing world, where it doesn't account for stage of a development. So the nascent industries of the developing countries are destroyed before they have a chance to be competitive in the rest of the world. And so developing countries remain underdeveloped. For decades and decades.
And I think that's where the most interesting part of this theory, the problems of the Ricardian theory are. If I'm recalling your book correctly, one of the examples used by Ricardo himself is cloth in England and wine in Portugal.
Yes, exactly.
And the problem there is what happened was the Portuguese stopped making cloth and England kept making cloth but stopped making wine. And so the Portuguese, through the development of their wine industry, created the best port in the world, but the English got the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Through all of the developments in the textile industry. So when you cut yourself off from a certain product and say, well, we aren't going to build any of this because we aren't going to have a competitive advantage in it compared to this other country, you're killing off industries that connect to other industries that lead to industrial development, that lead to economic growth. And it seems to fly in the face of every kind of financial advice that everyone always gets. We always tell individuals to have a diversified portfolio, but for some reason we're telling economies that a diversified economy is a bad thing.
And therein,
yes, exactly. And also, it points to one of the leading faults in the Ricardian model, which you also pointed to, Will, earlier. It doesn't have a time dimension.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all static. Sure, It could be a comparative the advantage in the Ricardian model will work well over a year's time, or 2 years' time, okay, or 3 years' time. But over 20 years, here's England. It's the Industrial Revolution, okay? And here's Portugal, just an old agricultural economy still plugging along.
And what's worse about that is if you look at Portugal at that time, they were a burgeoning empire. They were in Brazil. They were in India. Now, we generally don't recognize empire as a good thing in the modern era. But at the time, that was considered to be how countries grew economically, was to go conquer some piece of land across the ocean. They lost those possessions because back home, they were making wine while the Brits had stopped making cloth and started making cannons.
Right, and not only that, when they were making the cloth and selling it abroad, they did not follow a free trade model.
Mm-mm. Right, right.
They imposed on their colonies the requirement that they had to buy all their textiles from England.
Well, thank you both as a physicist for justifying the NASA budget. Moving on, we just have like two more minutes. Okay. So I wanted to ask a quick question. There is a huge conflation among progressives between the concept of balanced trade and fair trade. Joe, can you clarify those for us?
Right. What balanced trade would do, and it would come close to doing this, it would have this effect, is it would create a situation in trade where the exports were very close to the imports. Okay, sometimes the exports would be a little higher, sometimes the imports a little higher. Why? Because the exports and imports would be directly regulated by the government with certificates. Okay, but of course, there's no guarantee that to have that situation is going to produce conditions of fair trade if what you mean by fair trade is having, essentially wage standards that are, in reasonable alignment with each other, having environmental standards that are good for the future of the world. Having working conditions that are of a humane sort. None of these other conditions, which are key concepts in fair trade, are guaranteed by balanced trade.
Right.
And on the other hand, none of the things you want to see in fair trade guarantees that trade will be balanced.
So talk to me now about something you brought up in your book, and it's the first time I read this as a concept, trade for public purpose.
Yes, and it's the first time I've seen it as a concept, too. There are hints of it in Warren Mosler's work, of course.
Yes, I've seen that.
He makes statements talking about the role of public purpose, okay, in MMT reasoning, and he makes reference continuously to public purpose. But he never actually creates a framework where we're evaluating everything, including trade, including fiscal policy, in terms of the public purpose of those things. And he never talks about actually integrating your trade and your fiscal policy. And of course, that's clearly the logical thing to do, because if trade is creating domestic problems in your economy, if it's putting people out of work, if it's having a lot of unintended consequences in your economy, there are things the government can do using fiscal policy to compensate for that. Specifically, the government can facilitate, the creation of new industries. It can provide job guarantees for people and do that at a living wage.
Exactly.
And with good fringe benefits. There's a whole range of things the government can do to compensate with fiscal policy, as long as you believe that the federal government has no solvency problems and that it can run budget deficits as high as necessary to compensate for trade deficits and for savings. So, of course, the logical thing to do is to plan both your trade policy and your fiscal policy so that they will coordinate with each other. And that means you need a new set of institutions in the federal government. In other words, you have to add to the institutions of the federal government in order to facilitate this kind of integration of policy. I don't know if anybody's talked about that kind of integration of policy before.
I don't think they have.
Entirely new thing that comes out of the book.
Yeah, and I think that's what's really important. Everybody, the book is Who Needs Balanced Trade? Who Needs Balanced Budgets? It's available right now for download on Amazon. We've been talking today with Joe Firestone. You've been listening to Hopping Mad, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. This was a very enjoyable discussion.
Special online-only edition of an extended interview with Joe Firestone, the political scientist and economist, because we have a lot more to talk about when it comes to trade economies and modern monetary theory. So I guess my first question to really sort of hit at the importance of this is to just talk about some of the examples of where our economic systems have failed. I mean, I can think of just a few off the top of my head. There's the situation with quinoa, which is that wonderful grain that's no longer consumed by people who live in South America because all of it is being exported. There's no protectionist system in place to allow local people to still enjoy a product they've been enjoying for millennia. We talked in the pre-interview about Mongolia, where overgrazing has destroyed in a lot of very real ways their animal husbandry industry, which the IMF thought would be their main industry that they could just expand forever. We've talked about developing economies where everyone just told them, you guys need to just keep growing bananas and cocoa and do that better than everybody else and never develop any other industries. So let's talk about that, the problems with a trading system that tells countries, you should only do this.
It's not quite the trading system that tells countries that. It's a combination of the supposed commitment to free trade and the operation of the institutions, like the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, which enforces the bilateral trade treaties, okay, that are governing a lot of this. So, with regard to the Andes, okay, and the quinoa, the nations there have signed bilateral trade agreements with the United States that essentially prohibit protectionism on the part of those nations. Because they've committed to free trade, they have to allow the export of all their quinoa.
So
if they don't allow the export, okay, of all their quinoa, that's a violation of the trade treaty, and the United States, okay, or other nations will then take them to the World Trade Organization, okay, and get an investor-state dispute settlement action going to force the Peruvians or the Bolivians to, trade their quinoa, to allow international interests to buy the quinoa and to export the quinoa.
So I understand how trade for public purpose works as a domestic policy, but fair trade and balanced trade, to me, when I look at that, it almost necessitates enforcement by a supranational organization like, Christine Lagarde in the IMF. And we know how spectacularly badly they do their job right now. So exactly how is it that progressives see this enforced? Do you have any insight on that?
They see it as enforced by trying to put things in the treaties, trying to modify the TPP, okay, and TTIP, TISA, so that they contain goals and objectives, okay, and other provisions to stop this kind of exploitation. But the problem with what they're doing is that the procedures for settling disputes are all structured in such a way that the only entities that can sue for relief are multinational corporations.
Right.
The labor has no status. Public interest
right.
groups have no status. They cannot go to these private tribunals.
Right, because of the ISDS courts.
No, the ISDS courts, exactly. Investor State Dispute Settlement Courts. Now, those are courts staffed by corporate lawyers. In the provisions in the current treaties, the judges in the courts, okay, are rotating from case to case. And when they're not acting as judges in the courts, they work for corporations that...
Yeah, so how likely are they
to may be deciding
them?
In favor of in another 3 months or another 6 months or something like that. So the whole thing is totally biased towards corporations winning suits against but national governments. Okay, in other words, the parties to the suits are always national governments who supposedly violated a treaty. Okay.
Right.
Okay. So basically, these trade treaties are giving away national sovereignties to private corporate courts.
Right.
It's just incredible any nation would consider that.
It's insane.
Right. And so having that kind of system is itself an argument against the fair trade approach to politics. I'm sorry, to trade. And the free trade approach to trade. Now, I don't know if it's an argument against the balanced trade approach to trade, because the balanced trade approach to trade, the Buffett approach, is domestically enforced through the issuance of the certificates. So that doesn't really require a supranational a group to mediate, okay, or to arbitrate.
Okay. Out of curiosity, when it comes to things like, say, quinoa or exports that you don't want to be exporting, what are the options that states have under these trade agreements for something like export taxes? as a sort of punitive tax to economically discourage the export of something. Is that the same thing as the kind of tariffs? Is that because they're not directly stopping the export of a good, they're just making it less likely to be a successful good overseas. Is that something acceptable under these trade agreements?
No, I don't think so. In other words, there have to be specifically negotiated exceptions for particular goods. Okay, and to from
like
what
wheat
I know
in Japan.
Yes, but from what I know, what's going on there is that people are trying to protect their domestic industries from competition from the outside. So they'll get an exception to continue to use a tariff for a certain kind of product they make for domestic use. Okay, but an export tax on something, okay, in order to prevent its export, is not something I'm aware of anybody going for in terms of an exception to the trade treaties. Now, I'm sure it would be possible for them to negotiate that kind of exception, but I'm not aware of any case where they tried to do that.
One of the things you talk about in your book is the need for Congress to be more actively involved in the negotiation and approval of trade policies. So is it realistic to expect Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders to both be involved in negotiations?
Well, I'm not sure that it's realistic to have them both be involved. but what I'm saying is there are committees in Congress, okay, that are devoted to trade. Okay.
Sure.
In my mind, there's no reason why some members of those committees could not be part of a negotiation process along with corporations, some of the labor unions, public interest groups. There could be a much broader set of stakeholders. And also, there's absolutely no justification for Congress not being able to see the drafts of these treaties that they're going to have to approve. Now, I know that if Congress gets to see the draft of the treaties, okay, and they leak the drafts of the treaties, that that's going to make it harder for the treaties to pass. Okay, my response to that is, well, that's just too bad. If there's objectionable stuff in the treaties, everybody needs to know it early.
It should be harder to pass if there are objectionable things in the treaty. Just
should,
in this last
it
year.
It should be harder to pass. That's right. We should not have a bias towards wanting to create these treaties. We should have a bias against creating these because it's so easy to make mistakes.
One of the things in the last year, I had both one of my senators and my congressman in my manufacturing company. And one of the things I asked both of them was to push to have a much larger and very specific inclusion of small business in the negotiation of these treaties, because the priorities and the needs of small business are radically different than those of large business. For instance, small business would never have access to ISDS courts because we can't afford it.
That's right. Absolutely true. So these courts are only for large multinational corporations. In fact, they're not even for domestic corporations.
Right.
If a corporation is a purely domestic corporation, it would have no standing in these courts.
In your book, you talk about the concept of deficit neutral in the long run fiscal policy, and that it selects, the biggest problem with it is that it selects the wrong targets. Can you tell us about that a little bit more?
Sure. It's possible to break the economy down into three main sectors. There's the government sector of the economy. There's the private sector, the economy. economy, and there's the foreign sector. So there are three sectors. Now, when you look at these sectors within a time period, they are exchanging with each other. They are exchanging net financial assets with each other. The government puts net financial assets into the private sector. The private sector sends taxes and fees to the government. We send our money to the foreign sector for their goods. And as you know, there's a trade deficit there. So we send more of our money to them, to the foreign sector, than we get from the foreign sector. So the interesting thing about the balances of these flows is that within a time period, they all have to total to zero. And the reason why is because within a time period, the amount of net financial assets is seen as a constant. So since it's not expanding within a time period, certainly in the foreign sector and the private sector, okay, it's constant. It's possible for the government to add financial assets during a period, okay. But in any case, taking into account those it adds also, the flows have to be equal to zero.
Well, and something I say to people over and over and over again is that this isn't a theory. This is double entry accounting. It is as knowable as gravity.
Yes, and it's also an accounting identity, which means it's true by definition alone.
Right.
Okay, now, whether the definition is a useful thing to apply to reality is another question. Okay, but we think it is. And the reason why we think it is, okay, is simply because when there is money flowing from the private sector to the foreign sector on a net basis in a year, we're losing demand in the private sector. When there is also money flowing out of the private economy into savings in the private economy, that also takes away from the demand. So if to maintain full employment, for example, we need to rely on the full demand we have in our economy, and we're losing, let's say, 10% of that, 5% to trade, okay, and 5% of GDP to savings, then how do we replace the 10%? If we don't replace the 10%, then the economy is going to gradually go down. The rate at which it goes down depends upon how the private banks respond, okay, and whether a credit bubble is actually created. But of course, a credit bubble is no good for us in the long run anyway, because we're going to have a crash. So the point is to prevent the rise of the private debt in the economy and to maintain our demand, both of which are very important for us. The only thing that can be done about this is for government to deficit spend the 10% of GDP to compensate.
So that's the tie between international trade and fiscal policy right there.
Yeah, the tie is through the loss of the demand, okay, and the need to compensate for the loss of demand. That will either happen through increasing private debt, through loans, you know, so people get money through loans, okay, or it will happen through the government actually deficit spending. Now, since there's no harm in the government deficit spending to its solvency position, or to its net financial asset position, best thing for the people of any nation is to have the government deficit spend.
folks, if you don't understand why there's no harm in the government deficit spending, check on our website, iamhoppingmad.com, under additional podcasts and modern monetary theory. There's a link and you can listen to a podcast on that subject.
Okay, but also check on just a very brief statement, okay, I'm going to make now. When you do accounting and you're asking what's the net financial assets of a particular actor, okay, you have to look at their assets and you have to value it, okay, in terms of money. Now, the federal government of the United States has a particular asset which is very, very important, and that asset is the ability to create an unlimited amount of money. So that capacity to create money is infinite. So if the government of the United States decides to deficit spend, yes, it's losing money to the private sector, which the private sector is gaining, which is good for the private sector. But also, that loss is not a real loss to the federal government because it has that net financial asset capacity to create as much money as it cares to create for whatever it needs to do for itself and for us.
Which takes us back to the very first question, which is, what is real?
What is real? Right. And so... that money is certainly real in a certain sense, but it's also money we can effortlessly create by fiat in unlimited amounts. Now, that may not be wise to do, because if we create too much of it, we are going to have inflation, and we don't want to have inflation. But right. If we're losing a demand worth 10% of GDP each year, then... we can certainly afford to deficit spend to produce that 10% of GDP and place it in the private sector so we can avoid cycles, these economic cycles, okay, downturns.
Well, the bound on how much money the federal government can afford to spend into the economy are the bounds, I should say, are the exchange rate and inflation. And inflation is hard. It's hard to get to inflation. Ask Japan. In fact, ask the Fed. Trying to hold 2% inflation here has been, you know, the unicorn they've been reaching for the last 10 years. But I think that the biggest problem with the idea of inflation is that people confuse putting money out into the economy, Congress, spending money out into the economy with inflation. Inflation is related to supply and demand. And as long as there is sufficient supply in the U.S. marketplace, there won't be inflation.
Yes, I agree completely. And I also think that, you know, the simple example I've given, well, what happens if we have 5% of GDP leaking to savings and 5% of GDP that's going to trade. And so that means that we have the policy space to deficit spend 10% of the GDP. That example isn't really the truth. In other words, it may be somewhat close to it, but it's not actually the truth. And the reason why it isn't is because we're living here in a dynamic situation. As the federal government deficit spends into the private economy, the private economy is a moving target. It is probably, right, by virtue of that, going to increase the savings in the private economy. Whether they, in other words, it does this percentage-wise or not, no one can tell. But in absolute terms, the savings are going to increase. And also the trade deficit, okay, is going to increase. If those increase in percentage terms so that they now total more than 5% each of the economy, but they go up to 6% each, then that means the federal government won't just have to spend the 10% that was thought at the start, but to keep up, it will actually have to go to 12%. Okay?
Right.
So it's not a case where we know beforehand exactly how much the federal government is going to have to deficit spend. What we need are programs that are going to automatically adjust to shortfalls in the
countercyclically.
Countercyclically, right, but countercyclically aggressive enough and quickly enough that we smooth out the cycles.
Okay? Exactly.
Now, the deficit neutrality idea doesn't take account of these sectoral balances that I've talked about. Okay, it doesn't really take into account the possibility that trade deficits can last for years and years and years. For example, you know, in the United States, ours has lasted, what, for 40 years or something like that? It just goes on and on and on. So for all these 40 years, you've had a leakage of demand of U.S. dollars to foreign holders going outside of the economy of the United States and not coming back in.
And that has hurt us how?
By removing demand from the economy and by creating shortfalls in sales and therefore in employment.
Exactly.
It's the source of the stagnation in the economy, or one of the sources anyway.
Yes.
One of the two main sources in the stagnation of the U.S. economy over the years and the increasing stagnation. I mean, it's been increasing. We had a much, much better economy from 1945 to 1973 than we've had since 1973.
Well, but I think the main point for us, the big takeaway on for us, is that it's not up to us to compete with the Chinese or change Chinese policy. It's up to us to pressure our Congress to spend into the economy in such a way that they solve the problem, that they act in a counter-cyclical way, and that they provide jobs. That's easily done. That is entirely within our grasp. And it's solely within our grasp. We don't need anybody else's permission to do that.
Right, but I want to emphasize, it's not simply jobs. It's also the change in the structure, okay, of the economy. When our trade deficits cause certain of our industries to go overseas, we then need new industries here. The economy we have here has to adapt. The federal government should be supporting with massive funding the creation of new industries that will employ people. Now, you don't have to wait to employ people to create these new industries, but you employ people under federal job guarantees at first, but meanwhile, on a parallel track, you create those new industries as fast as you can also. Because for us, the trade deficits are kind of an opportunity. It takes the need to produce toys, for example, off the U.S. economy. It takes the need to produce, let's say, refrigerators off the U.S. economy. So,
and opens up space for, say, NASA.
Opens up space for other industries.
Right.
Opens up new opportunities for our people to work in other areas that maybe pay more instead of pay less. But for that to happen, you have to have an industrial policy which is very active and which is fueled very generously by fiscal policy.
Well, as the owner of an American manufacturing company, I am all about that.
Yeah, so am I. And I'm not the owner of a manufacturing company. Okay, any more questions?
No. Thank you, Joe. This has been great. We really appreciate your time. And I must say, we really need to have you back to talk about platinum coin seniorage and fiscal space, because that's another whole subject.
Yes, that is. That is another whole subject, entirely different subject. Okay, and also don't forget the previous books. Just on the last 2 or 3 months, one on trade as well, but specifically on the trade deals, focusing a lot on the TPP,
and then your great book on Greece.
Yeah, the book on Greece as well.
All of it.
I've got some more
Amazon.
Coming out. I've got some more coming out over the next couple of months, also.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Joe. Take care, and we just really appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you, Arliss.
Thanks,
and
Joe.
And Will, it was very nice to meet you and to talk with you.
It was fantastic. Well, everyone, you have been listening to the director's cut of Hopping Mad. Maybe we should call it Extra Mad. I'm not exactly sure.
That's great. But, that's great.
Yeah, but this is going to be a thing we will be doing when we can with guests who have a lot to talk about that we just can't squeeze into 20 minutes. So thanks for spending the extra time here with us. And we'll see you next time.